Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to start our program by taking a look at our groundwater here in Wisconsin. A little groundwater awareness we're going to be doing today with my two guests, Steve and Alyss. Steve is a regional drinking water supervisor for the South Central region of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kevin Masaryk is the outreach specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at the UW Stevens Point. So we got a couple of different areas of the state covered with these guys here, and certainly they're more than happy to answer your questions as we talk about the groundwater in the state. Judith was doing a little research, and she came up with a fact: if we could bring all the groundwater to Wisconsin to the surface, it would cover the whole state to a depth of 100 feet. Is that right, Steve?
Sounds about right. I've seen that. I didn't have to do the calculation, but I've seen that number cited over the years.
Man, well, it sounds like a lot.
It is quite a bit.
It is a lot, and we're really fortunate to have that supply of groundwater.
Yeah, Wisconsin is very fortunate in that in most parts of the state, we have accessible water in a reasonable depth from the ground surface. So it's fairly easy to get to.
So groundwater, you know, maybe it'd be worth it to come up with a definition for groundwater so everybody knows what we're talking about. Kevin, you want to do that?
Well, groundwater, it's important to realize, is really a local resource, and it originates as precipitation, rain, mm-hmm. or snow melt that infiltrates or soaks into the ground and eventually reaches a point below the land surface where all the empty spaces in between the soil or all the empty void spaces in the rock are completely filled with water. So that's really all groundwater is. It's not an underground lake. It's not an underground river.
Yeah.
And, it really does recharge locally. It's truly a community resource.
So our water is something Arizona would probably like to have about this time.
Oh, I think so.
And how many of our residents rely on groundwater here in the state? It's quite a bit, isn't it?
It's roughly 70% of the entire state's population, but it actually works out to about 95% of all communities that rely on groundwater. And if you live in a rural area, all the people with private wells, it's 100%. All of them rely on groundwater for their principal supply of water.
And we, our population's grown and it's going up. At current levels, usage levels, are we got a sustainable amount there?
I believe we've got a sustainable amount, but we do have to keep track of how well we're using it, making sure we're using it efficiently. I think for most parts of the state, with proper planning, we'll see water use shouldn't be a problem in terms of shortages.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment for our two guests today, Steve Alyss and Kevin Masaryk, join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you, certainly. Testing for groundwater, is it a good idea to have your groundwater tested? Kev?
Particularly since most rural homeowners rely on groundwater for their drinking water, we do recommend that people test their wells annually. Nitrate and bacteria every year is a good idea. There's some other things if you've never tested for them, such as arsenic, pesticides if they're applied locally. Those are additional tests that rural well owners might want to consider. Municipal groundwater or municipal systems that rely on groundwater, they have certain requirements for testing. And Steve is really familiar with a lot of those regulations.
Yeah,
actually, all of our public water supplies in the state, whether it be a rural tavern or restaurant or a city like Madison or a factory that's located out in the country, it's on their own well. If it's a public water supply, then there's a certain amount of required testing.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't emphasize enough, like Kevin just did, that for private homeowners, it's their responsibility to test their wells.
Test it out, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we get quite a report every year or even more than once a year from the water. I'm in Madison.
Once a year, you'll get what's called the Consumer Confidence Report.
It's quite a report.
It is. All community systems in the state produce that document.
You know, it's always interesting, and I always read it. Eugene in Viola has a comment or question for you. Hi, Eugene.
Hello, Larry. I remember that fight they got into over in Evans County with Pierre, the water bottling company, a number of years ago over in over at Big Springs there.
Yeah.
And Pierre lost on that, but they had to put up an awful fight in order to – the county there in that area over there had to put up an awful fight to win. And I wonder if there's any legislation to stop anybody from coming in and running high-capacity wells that would deplete our water table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a result of the Perrier proposal several years ago, there actually were some changes in state law, and specifically, as you mentioned, in how we address high-capacity wells. If a well produces more than 100,000 gallons per day, they need an approval, specific approval from the Department of Natural Resources. And now, as a result of legislation after the Perrier situation, we review all of the high-capacity well proposals to determine what their impacts to local springs, to outstanding and exceptional resource waters, that type of thing. So as a result of the Perrier proposal, we do now have legislative tools that we can use to study the impacts of a high-capacity well.
All right, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Chuck in Holy Hill, we go to you. Hi, Chuck.
How you doing? I just heard like 40 years ago they started using salt out east, and then finally now it's gotten into the water tables out east, and do we have to be concerned about the salt that they put on the roads getting into our water tables here, especially since I have a dug well, a 30-foot deep dug well, and it's all in good shape and everything, but it's about 100 or so, 100 some feet from the road where they put salt on, and I'm concerned about the salt actually getting into this dug well.
No, okay. What do you think? Is that an issue that we should worry about, Kevin?
I would say that anything we do on the land surface has the potential to reach our groundwater. And certainly, I do a lot of testing with private wells and rural homeowners. And we do, in fact, see things like chloride from road salt showing up in people's wells. In fact, a lot of times the highest concentrations of chloride we find near major highways or near major intersections.
Yeah.
Or near more metropolitan areas. So these are things to be aware of. I think cities are doing a better job of managing how much salt they apply. But homeowners, too, have a tendency to put a lot of salt on after an ice storm or after a snowstorm. So we can all do a better job of managing the amount of salt we apply to those surfaces.
Now, if you have salt, I mean, what if sodium shows up in your drinking water, what do you do?
I think in the couple situations I've dealt with, it's usually been such a gradual increase of the chloride, and that's what you would be tasting.
Yeah.
That most homeowners aren't going to notice. We've had a couple situations over the years where people have been on low-sodium diets and have had to re-drill a well, but that's a pretty, you know...
drastic measure.
Yeah, but it's also a pretty low percentage of people that would be in that situation.
All right.
But I think what Kevin spoke to earlier really illustrates this situation. A 30-foot well is a relatively shallow well.
Yeah.
And is definitely in a situation where it could be affected by nearby land use.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Chuck, for calling. Appreciate it. Randy in Laval, we turn to you next. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I had had the great privilege years back of enforcing some groundwater rules here in a municipality and came up with a campaign. I wondered if you'd ever heard of it. It really was quite popular at the time, and I made a bumper sticker. One of your field offices picked it up even at the time. It was called Stop Those Dirty Runs of Ditches. And people liked it. It was kind of popular, humorous a little bit. And then I gave that out. It showed up everywhere, really. And the little humorous bent to it allowed me then to go on and say, well, this is how we do it. And really, I was able to recruit people on the positive side of the issue to start doing the job, the techniques correctly, who became advocates for stopping runoff from construction sites and even municipal sites that some of our workers didn't realize where they were allowing really things to creep off danger zones that they had before, and the humorous little bent broke the ice. I wondered if you'd ever heard of my little campaign.
Well, I know they're both shaking their heads no. What kinds of campaigns or what kinds of information do we try to get out now to people, and how do we do it? Well, this is one example. You're on the air with me, Kevin. What else do you try to do?
One of the things that we do every year is try to give away these groundwater sand tank models to local schools.
Mm-hmm.
They are the best educational tool for people to understand and learn about groundwater. So reaching out to local schools is one technique. I also do a lot of outreach at local river group mm-hmm. events, local lake associations. Mm-hmm. If they have concerns or questions about groundwater, we try and do what we can to get them the information that they need.
And what about, go back to that school thing once, because people are going to say, well, what the heck is that? How does that work, or what does it show?
Every year in November, there's an application process for teachers to attend one of these workshops and receive a groundwater model. And the idea is just to dispel some of the myths that people have and get these models into the classrooms, into the communities, so that people can actually see how groundwater works, how it's connected to lakes, rivers, and streams, and how what we do on the land surface can contaminate or potentially affect the groundwater below us.
Now, is it a poster or is it an actual model?
It's an actual physical sand tank model.
Okay.
That you can put water in, and you add a little bit of dye to it,
mm-hmm.
and you can see that when the dye moves, the dye is representing the flow or the direction of groundwater movement. It's a highly visual tool.
Sounds cool.
And if there are educators out there that want more information on those models, feel free to contact me.
And how did they do that?
My email address is kmasarik, M-A-S-A-R-I-K, at uwsp.edu. That's probably the most effective.
You know what? We'll put that up on our Facebook page, and Judith will get that up on the Facebook page so that if people are interested and want to get that, they will be able to find it.
And I can speak to the effectiveness of that model, and that about 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was in a meeting with some water well drillers, people who are experienced in the industry. And we used the sand tank model, and it was a very effective tool to really display visually how water can move through the subsurface. It's a nice plexiglass tank, and it's very visual.
Very cool. Well, we'll put that up on our Facebook page so that people will, if they didn't get your email address, they'll have it. Nancy in Menominee Falls, we turn to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have two questions. My first is about the chlorine smell in my water. We moved in our new house 10 years ago, and we wanted the cold water at the kitchen sink to be fresh water and not softened. You know, it just tastes better. And it did taste better. And then a few years, it started to smell like chlorine. And now when you run it full cold water, there's no way you could drink that. The smell would be like you opened a can of bleach or a bottle of bleach.
Are you on a municipal system?
We are on, we have part well and part Milwaukee water. And I know the Milwaukee water, the lake water, is good water coming from Milwaukee. So I am wondering.
Yeah, I think what you're probably smelling is actually it's actually a chloramine, and essentially it's a reaction with the chlorine is put into water to provide a disinfectant
right.
to kill bacteria. But chlorine will react with organic material that's dissolved in the water and produce something called a chloramine. And people's noses are, in fact, very, very sensitive to the smell of chloramine. You know, I think you could talk to your water supplier and see if there is an issue in your particular area.
I asked my neighbors, and they all have softened all their water.
Okay.
I don't like to drink softened water, no. But they don't mind it.
The one other thing I could recommend to you is that that vapor will come out of the water. So if you actually put the water into a pitcher and just leave the pitcher on your counter or put it in your refrigerator, within a couple hours, that'll all come out. So it's not obviously as handy as just turning on the kitchen tap, but that's a very simple way that you could get rid of that chlorine smell.
I would add that activated carbon or activated charcoal filters, mm-hmm. A lot of the filters that you find in your refrigerator, Those do a really good job of removing that chlorine smell or taste as well.
Okay. I do have a second question.
Okay.
And that is about the radium that's in the Waukesha County water.
Mm-hmm.
I know they have had high levels, and at one time they were supposed to get their water fixed. We had a friend who had a well, and there was actually so much radium in that water in the well that three of their children got thyroid cancer. And I'm just wondering how what's happening now with Waukesha
okay.
water.
Yeah, I'm not Waukesha is out of the area that I'm most familiar with. I don't regulate over in the southeast part of the state, but Waukesha, I believe, is working to gain Lake Michigan water. They are working with Department of Natural Resources staff on coming up with a solution there, but I apologize. I don't know the specifics of that situation.
Okay. Who would she contact to find out?
Probably the best thing to do would be to contact the Drinking Water and Groundwater Program. You can call our central office and ask for someone in the Public Water Program.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much, Nancy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about our groundwater here in Wisconsin with Steve Aless, Regional Drinking Water Supervisor for the South Central Region of Wisconsin, works with the DNR. And Kevin Masaryk is the Outreach Specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at UW-Stevens Point. Questions? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Searce-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Aless and Kevin Masaryk are guests here today as we talk groundwater awareness with them. Appreciate you listening in, and certainly join in with your questions and comments. John in West Bend has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
I have some real concerns about farmers putting manure on frozen fields without knifing it in. We live in somewhat of a rural area, and it's been put on in layers and layers and layers, and some of the houses, the wells in the area are going bad from E. coli, and right now there's a lot of big ponds on the fields and stuff, ponds of manure and liquid manure, and on 50, 60-degree days, like even a day like today, I have orange water running across my property and directly into wetlands. I was just wondering... their wells are about 160 feet deep, and mine's at about 185. And I was just wondering what my probabilities of getting a bad well happening here.
Well, I can't speak to the processes of the rules with respect to land spreading and manure, but one thing I can tell you or anybody listening is this is manure spreading season. Manure has been building up over the winters. Farmers have been storing it in lagoons, and this is the time of year when they're out spreading the manure. And we do get our highest concentration of calls of people that think they have manure in their wells. And the message I really would like to get out there is that for anybody listening, if you've got a private well and your water all of a sudden starts smelling like manure, you turn on the tap and the color has changed, the aesthetic has changed, it reminds you of a barnyard, we really want you to call your local DNR office. Or if you can't, you can call our call center. The call center is 1-888-936-7463. And we really want to start gathering information from people. We hear lots of anecdotal stories, and we deal with a number of confirmed cases every year of manure affecting private water supply wells. We have some analytical techniques that we like to run on wells that we think are affected by manure. With respect to the probability of your well being affected, you know, that's just too hard to say without knowing the specific geology of your area. But to you, your neighbors, and really anywhere around the state, this time of year or any time of year, the situations where manure affects a well, it's usually very obvious. You'll be using the water in the morning, and an hour or two later you turn it on, and it is drastically different. And that is something the Department of Natural Resources Drinking Water Program really wants to hear from people. We want to really start gathering information about that around the state.
Okay, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. An email from Carolyn DeForest spends a lot of time in Door County and in Madison. I'm very concerned about the quality of the water in the Great Lake, Michigan, I assume, and also in our Madison Lakes. What's your position on the reduction of pollution controls for rivers and lakes that's in the budget? Kevin, I'll turn to you for that.
I guess I'd have to say I haven't read the budget closely enough to know if there's anything specifically that deals with monetary issues and those controls. What I will say is that when we talk about the Great Lakes and Madison Lakes, there's two different components of water entering those systems. There's surface water and there's groundwater. And a lot of the things that we do on the land surface, some of them like phosphorus, which I know is something that's been in the news lately, that's more of a surface water issue.
Mm-hmm.
Runoff from farm fields is carrying sediment or sediment that's rich in phosphorus or manure that's being spread that's rich in phosphorus into the lakes. So that's typically more of a surface water issue than a groundwater issue. I don't know of anything specifically in the budget that deals with groundwater. Therefore, I guess I'd have to say that's not my area of expertise.
Okay. A caller wanted to know if water that evaporates from lakes and rivers is gone or does it stay in the system? Kevin, you explain that?
Anything that evaporates off the surface of a lake or a river or a stream is going to go back into the atmosphere, and it's going to fall back down to the land surface as precipitation somewhere else. If we think about how much rain we get each year in Wisconsin, on average, and this is an average, it depends each year based on how wet or how dry
sure.
it is, but we get about 32 inches of rain a year,
mm-hmm.
and about 20 inches of that get sent back to the atmosphere as either evaporation or through transpiration by plants and trees and crops. So the vast majority of water that falls on the land surface is water that evaporated from somewhere else. It's a cycle. So it's gone. It goes back into the air. But it's going to fall back down to the land surface, either close by or far away.
And we had an email from Sandra in Beaver Dam. We have an oily film on top of our well water. Could this be from the groundwater or maybe from our pipes?
There's a couple things. First of all, I would recommend you contact a local pump installer and have them come out and look at it. There's a couple things that come to mind when I hear of an oily sheen on a water. One is that it's possible that you've got an older pump and an oil is leaking out of your pump. So that's the first thing you want to have checked. Is this an oil that's coming out of your pump?
Yeah.
Maybe the pump has failed for some reason. The other thing that comes to mind actually is iron bacteria. Iron bacteria are not harmful to people, but they can get established in plumbing systems. And when an iron bacteria gets well established, they'll produce an oily-looking sheen on the surface water, on a cup of water,
sure.
that type of thing. So those are the two things I would look at, but I would recommend you get in contact with a pump installer.
Another question from Addie in Madison. What about contamination of our groundwater by pharmaceuticals? Are drugs showing up in our water supply?
This is an area where the research is ongoing. Analytical techniques are becoming better, and I would say the ability to detect these things in groundwater, in water in general, is finally coming to fruition. So the more we research it, the more I guarantee you we will find that these things are getting into the water supply. I think the big question is, at what level, and are they at levels that are a concern to human health? And the research on that is still ongoing. I mean, it's going to be while before we have a definitive answer on that.
Jerry and Toma, let's turn to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I think you already answered my question. It was concerning the impact that this would have on the budget, because I had heard that Governor Walker was eliminating a lot of programs to clean up the lakes and stuff, but I guess you had kind of already answered that.
All right. I guess, Kevin, any other comments you wanted to make?
I think everybody in Wisconsin really appreciates the quality of our natural resources. And I hope whatever path the state takes, I hope that we have the best interest of our lakes, our rivers, and our groundwater in mind.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. Zach in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Zach.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
I have kind of a conservation question, I guess.
Okay.
What kinds of things can people do to recover and reuse gray water? And I'll go off the air.
Yeah, and for those who may not know what gray water is, you want to comment on that, Kevin?
Well, we have potable water, which is water that we can use for any purpose, drinking, bathing, showering. And then there's gray water, which is water that has previously been used for something else. And in Wisconsin, those regulations to allow water reuse is what we call it, they are out there. The Department of Commerce has developed guidelines for people that want to reuse water in their house or in their business. And the main thing to keep in mind is that we can reuse water, but it has to meet certain standards. So as long as you're treating that water for the intended use, you can do that. But there is a permitting process, permits that you need to obtain to be able to incorporate that into your home. Now, using rainwater is something that anybody can do. If you're going to use that rainwater for, let's say, watering your garden or watering your lawn, that's something anybody can do simply by installing a rain barrel on their house and collecting the water off their gutter. If you wanted to use that water in the home, however, let's say to flush toilets, then you would need to talk to somebody from the Department of Commerce to see how exactly you'd go about that.
Mm-hmm. We use about 60 gallons per person per day of water, something like that?
It's about right. And if you think about it, only 15% of the water we use on a regular basis in our homes actually needs to be potable. The water that we use, the vast majority of it, for things like flushing the toilet, watering our garden, that really doesn't need to be drinking water quality water. So this idea of water reuse is probably the greatest advance in conservation that's up and coming in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And there are ways, and we can certainly go back and talk, there are a lot of ways that we can cut back on our water, and I'm sure you guys talk about it. I know we're doing a remodel on a home, and what we put in for toilets, for example, there's a kind of a big button and a little button, or a smaller button on, and you know, you use one for one and the other, the larger one for the other, and that's one way to save a little water, I hope.
Oh yeah, EPA has been very active in promoting a program called Water Sense Labeling, and many of the fixtures, plumbing fixtures you can get, you can look for that Water Sense Labeling as part of that.
Yeah, it's well, at least we certainly hope it helps.
I would add to that. The other thing where there's a large volume of water that's being used is for showering, particularly if you're a family that has a lot of teenage children at home. There's a lot of water used for the shower, and efficient shower heads, it's amazing the amount of money that people can save, not only on water, but energy costs, since the bulk of that water coming through the shower head is hot water. There's significant energy savings if you have very inefficient fixtures on your household plumbing system.
Well, how do you know what's an efficient and what's an inefficient shower head, for example?
The newest shower heads, the most efficient ones, are about 1.28 gallons per minute. To figure out your gallons per minute, take a gallon bucket and time how long it takes, how many seconds it takes to fill that bucket up to the 1 gallon mark. Take 60 seconds divided by the number of seconds it takes to fill that bucket up, and that gives you your gallons per minute. If it's much more, let's say it's 2 or 3 gallons per minute, you would probably save quite a bit of money. The payback time on one of those fixtures would be a matter of a month or two.
Well, and they're usually advertised. I mean, when you go to look, there'll be something like, what do they call them, low-flow shower heads?
Low-flow shower heads, low-flow toilets, and almost all of those will be labeled with the gallons per minute or gallons per use.
Yeah, so it's certainly well worth your time to take a look at that. Michelle in Stevens Point, on to you. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling from Stevens Point. as you all know, Central Wisconsin has a lot of large farm producers, and they use, they're one of our top users of water. And there have been a lot of panel discussions and you know, community discussions on this recently here. I think for two reasons, you know, and my question, or I'd like a comment from either of you on, one, the access to water that agricultural producers have. You know, my water bill is going up in my locality. It's going up astronomically because of the new system they put in the Whiting area. And yet farmers can take and take and take to for their production. And at the same time that they're doing that, they're introducing pesticides and herbicides into the land, which take, you know, which they are harming the land at the same time. And so mine is a bigger picture question.
Yeah.
And if one of you could address, I'd like to know whether there's what the level of monitoring is on large farm operations in
okay.
Central Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Kevin, you want to start on that?
Sure. George Kraft from the office that I work at has been involved in a lot of research looking at that quantity aspect of the irrigation wells in the Central Sands. And I'd point out to people that there's looking at the water being withdrawn from one well, and then there's looking at the combined effect of all these basically straws in the groundwater system and what effect all of those straws have on the groundwater resource as a whole. And it does look like there are some effects. When you look at the groundwater system, there is some decline in the water table as a result of all that water being pumped out of the ground. If we think about irrigation, the USGS estimates that it's about a 90% consumptive loss of water that's pulled out of the ground. And that effect on the groundwater aquifer is going to be very noticeable, or much more noticeable, on the high points of the landscape. So those are the areas that are going to see the greatest decline in the water table as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Michelle. Appreciate your call. We have a question from Jerry. As I read the question on the email, I was thinking about LUST, which is the acronym for leaky underground storage tanks. But he says, my neighbor has a buried 1,000-gallon fuel oil tank, a used tank when it was put in 30 years ago. No problem as yet, but this is a disaster waiting to happen, I'm afraid. Any ideas on who to contact or what to do?
Well, if that was just a private use tank, probably for home heating oil, you know, there are regulations with respect to the storage of the tank, but once it's in the ground, it's going to be up to that homeowner to really recognize if the tank is leaking, if they're losing material. If there's been a release from a tank, that does need to be reported to the Department of Natural Resources, and an investigation into the degree or extent of the soil and or groundwater contamination would have to take place. With respect to his well, I think the thing to do is just be aware of changes in any of the aesthetic features of his water. If he's overly concerned, he can get the water tested for what are called volatile organic compounds. Those would include gas and fuel oil type compounds.
And a caller heard that jet and rocket fuel are among the top three water contaminants in the country. Is that true, as far as you guys know?
That number, I think, I would be surprised. I think gasoline would probably be the greatest just because there are so many
yeah.
more gas tanks around, whereas
yeah.
your jet and rocket fuel are clearly going to be only at your airports. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of gas tanks all over the country at every gas station.
Let's go to Tom in Cumberland now. Tom, hello.
Hi. You had said at the beginning of the show that private well owners should have their water tested annually. How and where do you get it tested?
Good question.
If you look at the, you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, and if you type in the upper right-hand corner, you see a search, you can go to Drinking Water and Groundwater Program, and look under the private well section, and there should be a list there that you can get to for the list of approved labs in the state for, namely for bacteria, but you can also, I think there's also a list there of labs that will do organic testing. But I think by starting with the bacteria and the nitrate, and most of those labs or many of those labs will also do some metals testing to do the arsenic that Kevin referred to. I don't know if you know of another listing, Kevin, of labs.
That's the best one to go to. It's simply typing in what's wrong with my water into a search engine should take you directly to that DNR webpage, and it's got all the information you need to decide what to test for and the labs where you can submit a sample.
And there are specifics on bottles and all that.
Yeah, and that can all be arranged by the lab. You contact the local lab. They'll mail you the sampling kit with the instructions on how to collect the sample, how to preserve the sample, shipping time, that type of stuff. And just to reiterate that phrase Kevin used, what's wrong with my water, that's a very, very useful tool for people to self-diagnose problems with their drinking water.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks very much, Tom. Sherry in Wales, we go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, how can we help?
Well, I actually have just a comment on conservation. Mm-hmm. When someone mentioned if you have several teenagers in the house, my children are all grown now, but when they were home, because we were not only on a private well, but our own septic system, we actually had a kitchen timer in our bathroom, so that our children, in addition to a low-flow shower head, have a limited amount of time in the shower. So just a suggestion. This is really a great topic, and thanks for bringing it on. And I'll take comments off the air.
All right. Sounds like a good idea to me.
Say that's an excellent tip.
I like that. Timer, if it goes off, turn the water off. So I guess it would teach you, let's just train people to get in there. And bathe quickly and get it over with. Kim in Black Earth, hi to you. Hi, Kim.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on. I know you don't have much time. I just wanted to know if you could educate me. I'm not a native, but why all the water conservation, discussion if the stewardship, like that one lady a few callers back had pointed out that we can just poison it in any way we want to. Also, if you could stand in, like you, Larry, mentioned at the beginning of the show, 100 feet of water, and also all the rainfall. I just don't understand why are we...
It's worried about conserving. Okay, thanks, Kim. And Kevin, we'll turn to you for that.
Yeah, the statistic about bringing all the groundwater to the land surface and how deep it would cover the state is a little bit misleading, because there are parts of the state that don't have adequate groundwater for municipal or private well needs. And then we also have to consider that groundwater is what supplies our lakes, our rivers, and our streams. So pulling the water out of the ground, using it somewhere else, is going to negatively affect those resources that rely on that constant groundwater recharge to support whole ecosystems. So this is why we really are concerned in Wisconsin about water conservation, because most of us feel that our lakes, rivers, and streams, clean resources like that add to our quality of life. And if they're degraded, whether it's pollution or whether it's quantity, that affects our quality of life here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And another factor related to that is the energy costs. As Kevin alluded to earlier, the water has to be pumped out of the ground. That can take an awful lot of energy. It has to be pumped through distribution systems at municipal systems. That takes an awful lot of energy. And if we can reduce the amount of pumpage, we'll reduce the amount of energy usage.
Thank you for that question and comment, Kim. And Steve and Kevin, thank you so much. Hopefully you'll come back and be with us again.
I'd be glad. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you both very much. Steve Allis is Regional Drinking Water Supervisor for the South Central Region of the DNR, and Kevin Masaryk, Outreach Specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at the UW-Stevens Point. We'll be back. We'll have them back, and we'll do this again. Well, thinking about water, surface water, one of the things I really enjoy seeing on the surface water every year are the loons, and we're going to be talking about our loons in Wisconsin with Stan Dekila. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.